Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to a very special episode of the Film Stories podcast.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Film Stories. We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew, as always. That's everything you need to know about me. The end of the podcast, though, well, it's given away in the title. I'm here to talk of the stories of films, and I tend to talk about development stories, production stories, marketing stories, release stories, all the ingredients, really, that go towards making the films that we know and sometimes love just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The films I tend to cover in this podcast lean more towards the mainstream than anything else. They're films I'm interested in or invested in to some degree. I try not to do snark. I try not to punch down. This podcast is a celebration of cinema and a real appreciation of just how hard it is sometimes to get a film made. Now, what you've happened upon here is one of my occasional special episodes of the podcast where I bring in a filmmaker to talk about their latest release and some of their previous work. That's certainly the case here. I'm delighted to welcome to this episode of Film Stories writer, director and producer Jeff Wadlow. Now, we're talking at the Press Junket, actually, for his 2024 horror Imaginary, which is being released in UK cinemas just as this podcast is being unleashed into the world. There are other films we talk about briefly in the midst of it. His featured directorial debut was 2005's Cry Wolf. There is an action film I mentioned that he made with four cameras called Never Back Down. He's also directed films. These are films we talk about. Kick-Ass 2 comes up. Truth or Dare comes up as well. And also, well, I'll let him tell you about the little festival that he's been running for 20 years of his life. I briefly mentioned Bernard Rose's film Paper House as well, and Hal Ashby's movies being there, both of which I hugely recommend, but it turns out they're a little bit of a side in the conversation you're about to hear. And that's all you need to know going in, really. I'm going to set it up with a clip from the trailer for Imaginary, produced by Jason Blum. His name certainly comes up as well. And then the other side of that, you'll hear my conversation with Jeff Wadlow.
Every culture has a name for it. We call them imaginary friends.
How does it feel being back?
Good. I had such good memories here. Maybe my happy place can be our happy place.
I left you all alone down here.
It was just my imagination.
I'm playing a new game with Chauncey.
The scavenger hunt list, that's fun.
Chauncey says you're not allowed to play with us.
Oh.
Because you left him. I need something happy.
Something happy? Ugh, that bug freaked you out.
If I can finish my list, Chauncey will take me on a trip to the place he's from.
Something that hurts.
Alice?
But
You've been spending time with a new friend?
That was a clip from Imaginary. I'm delighted to be joined for this Film Stories podcast special by its director, its co-writer, its producer, Jeff Wadlow. Wadlow?
You got it.
That right.
You got it.
I got it. Thank goodness. Nothing could possibly go wrong from this point onwards. Hello. Do we find you well, first of all? Congratulations on making another film. That seems a good place to start.
Right? It's no small feat to get a movie made. I'm doing very well. Thank you for asking. Thrilled to be here and just excited to get our movie out into the world.
Can I start in the logical place then and ask about the Adrenaline Film Project? Because I've just while I was waiting to talk to you, I just want to briefly mention this before we get into the film proper. I've not seen anything like this before. And if I've got this right, this is you basically almost going back to your roots and providing the kind of prize that will get other people into filmmaking. Can you just give me a quick précis of that, and then I'll ask you imaginary questions?
First of all, I'm thrilled that you're asking about that. I'm at a press junket right now, and you're the first person to bring it up. And it's a project that's near and dear to me. I started it 20 years ago in my hometown of Charlottesville, Virginia. I go back there for 72 hours, often with other Hollywood professionals. And we lead a film workshop with 12 teams of filmmakers. Each team has 3 filmmakers on it. And we help them produce a short film in 72 hours. So the very first night, we give them all unique genres. Then they have to come back and pitch us their short films. They have to get their pitch greenlit. Then they write the script overnight. Then I help them rewrite it with the other industry mentors I bring in. Then we greenlight their script. We help them cast it. We find local actors. And then they shoot it, and we go and we visit the sets. I'll often guest direct a scene with them. And then they bring their footage back on Friday night. They start editing. They edit all night long. Then Saturday during the day, I go and I look at rough cuts. I give them notes as if I was producing their film in Hollywood. And then they finish the films, and then we screen them Saturday night and have a big party and give out cash prizes.
And so this was something you started when you weren't a major all-conquering Hollywood director, and you've kept going now that you're a major all-conquering Hollywood director.
I mean, it's something I started when I was in my 20s. I think I'd made my first film already, but I only had one film under my belt. It was Cry Wolf for Universal Pictures that I made for $1 million. And I thought it would just be like a one-off for the Virginia Film Festival because I was on their board. And it's just kind of taken on a life of its own. And Lighthouse Studios now runs it. And it's really just been one of the things in my career that I'm the most proud of. So thank you for bringing it up.
It's an absolute pleasure to bring it up. I think it's great. I think it's great. You were in the UK once upon a time making Kick-Ass 2.
Yes.
And a colleague of mine spoke to you there. And you talked there about the touch point for that was The Warriors. So I think I've got the Adrenaline Film Project and The Warriors into the first couple of minutes of this. My bingo card is nearly full. What is it? I was always taken with that because that was such a left field choice compared to the route you could have gone with that film. What is it that gets you personally to commit 2 years to a story? Do you need a touch point like that? Is there an entry point, a eureka moment?
Listen, I'm just a fan of film and pop culture. Yeah. I love comic books. I love action figures and TV shows and I just consume it all. So I have a lot of references kind of floating around in my brain. And I try to find a touchstone. I try to find like one or two movies that I can really latch on to when I'm working on something new. And it might not be obvious to the layperson, but it's really speaking to me and the choices that I'm making as I write, shoot, and then edit the film.
So I guess 2 films for Imaginary, which are bound to be wrong, but I got Hal Ashby's Being There and Bernard Rose's Paper House.
I'm not familiar with Paper House, but I do know Being There. I'm going to check it out after these interviews. I am familiar with Being There. It was not a touchstone, but I appreciate the reference. I would say the 2 major references for me on Imaginary were the 1982 original Poltergeist, and honestly, Guillermo del Toro's Pan's Labyrinth. That's a bit of a mouthful, but yes,
space. Masterpiece.
Pan's Labyrinth was a major touchstone for us, just because it's, you know, the dark fantasy elements, the practical creatures, this idea of telling really a horror movie through the eyes of a child with adult themes and ideas. And that's what we were trying to do with Imaginary.
Does that also inform the way you make it then? I mean, going to Poltergeist, I mean, there was an ILM documentary whose name I've completely forgotten that popped up on Disney Plus. And they showed how they made the house implode in Poltergeist, which I had no idea to that point. I watched that well underage and just accepted it as was. I read right through the end credits of your film, and you've got puppeteers. You've got a lot of old style craft into this film. So does when you talk about a touch point, is it also behind the camera as well as in front of? Is it in your total approach?
It's all the above. So backing up to, you said a lot there, and I want to touch on all of it.
Yeah, sorry.
the ILM documentary is on Disney Plus, and it is fantastic. It's actually a series.
Yes.
I've watched every episode where they charge.
Light and Magic. Thank you to whoever's in the chat who's just reminded me it's called Light and Magic.
It's a great title. And it tells the story of ILM from creation to contemporary times. And there's a lot of interesting stories, not only how it sort of came into being through Star Wars and how it took on a life of its own after Star Wars, but then also the transition from practical effects to CG. And that kind of speaks to a comment you made as you were talking there about how I had puppeteers and old school techniques in the film. I don't even view those as old school techniques. I view those as necessary techniques, because when I'm making a movie, I want to try to do everything I can practically, because with the understanding that I'm going to augment it with VFX. It's what I call a hybrid approach, because when you do it practically, you give the audiences something to react to. It forces you to make choices on the set. You don't just say, oh, we'll figure it out with VFX later on. It feels more real for the audience because it's obeying the laws of physics. It's interacting with light in a realistic way. And if you're going to do VFX augmentation, you're actually getting great reference for the VFX artist by shooting this thing on the set. And then you have a plan for a VFX augmentation that elevates it, that kind of hopefully fools the audience, and you hide the seam between the two worlds. Often I'll use VFX to augment the thing you're not looking at. So if it's something that we're puppeteering with rods, the puppet is real, but then we'll paint out the rods. We'll paint out the puppeteers that are actually in the shots. In Imaginary, for example, you know, I don't want to give away any spoilers, but Chauncey, our teddy bear, becomes something so much more. And it's a practical creature with a performer, but then we're using like old school radio control servos to manipulate the monster. But then there is an aspect to the monster, which is CG. And it's just enough that you kind of aren't sure what you're looking at. And it allows you to believe in the fantasy of the moment.
Does that help as a filmmaker when key performers in your film are young as well? Because you've got a couple of extraordinary young performers here. You've got Piper Braun, I think, for instance, is playing Alice. But does it help? I grew up reading movie magazines, and they're telling me people look at ping pong balls and things like that. I was just like, well, how can you emote opposite a ping pong ball compared to next to something big and non-spoilery here? And does it help actually as much as the technical problems of it must be hell? Does it help when you're actually making the film and you've got the actors on a set?
Well, kids are interesting to work with, and I've worked with a lot of kids now at this point in my career.
Yes.
There are a lot of challenges. Obviously, nothing is more important than their safety and well-being, and there are laws around child labor that we abide and we're actually very strict about. We make sure they're getting their schooling because, you know, we want to take care of them and we want to protect them.
Yes.
Nothing's more important.
And to be clear, I'm not implying that you're terrorizing children and holding them against their will.
But then, no, they want to be there. If anything, sometimes they get upset when I send them to school. But what's actually great about an actress like Piper is she is so good. I mean, she is next level. She's like a Dakota Fanning, Drew Barrymore, young Jodie Foster. And so when she's on set, everyone's got to bring their A game, right? Because even like my actors, you know, they've done a lot of movies and TV shows. It's not uncommon for even the most talented professional actors sometimes to know it's going to be an easy scene. It's going to be an easy day. But if they're in a scene with Piper, they better be ready to hit the ball back, because She is just an incredible, jaw-dropping talent. So she is a pleasure to have on set. And even like the grips and electricians have a pep in their step when Piper's around because she's just so sunny and fun. And then as far as like, you know, her reacting to a real thing, yes, I think it's just easier for anyone. Forget whether they're an adult or a child. When you have something real to react to, it's easier. That being said, even with like having these real monsters, inevitably you get into coverage, you get into close-ups and moments where the monster's not in the shot. I'm not going to make the super former like do their thing off camera. It's just too taxing.
Yes, so I'm still so mean.
Yeah, I'm still talking Piper through what she's seeing. You know, in that final scene when she's watching what's happening, that's not actually happening in front of her. Like I just talked her through it, but she's so talented, you believe that she is watching it.
I mean, it's an aside, but the last time a major Muppet movie came out, I watched a child talking to a Muppet, and they were just completely oblivious to the human being who had its hand up it, basically. I mean, it was just the most incredible. I mean, it's the most incredible, like, goosebump thing to see it and just to see just how primal that was, just the interaction between the two of them.
When I was in the UK making Kick-Ass 2, they were shooting a Muppet movie on the sound stages next to us. At Pinewood, and I went over there and got to like tour the set and met the puppeteers and like got to like talk to Miss Piggy, because the puppeteers, even though the puppeteer is like right there holding the Muppet and you're like making eye contact and he's talking and her voice is coming out of his mouth, you can't help but turn into a kid and just like look at Miss Piggy and talk to Miss Piggy. And she was like rubbing my chest and telling me how like handsome and hairy I was, but I wasn't green enough. I wasn't her type. I mean, and you just, how can you not just go along with that? It's wonderful. It's why we love movies. It's why we love, you know, playing make-believe.
One of the lovely stories that that you told once upon a time was about Truth or Dare. And about how Truth or Dare just started with a title. You got a phone call, just like Universal wants to make this film, and you had three words to make a film come together. Mm-hmm. Which I would imagine I had loads of fun with Truth or Dare. I'd imagine it is both freeing and terrifying at the same time. What was the start point on Imaginary? Because I'm looking at a poster which has a teddy bear that looks particularly unnerving and a particularly fine tagline as well. Do you get that kind of snapshot? Is it as simple as that for you, just in terms of firing the starting gun?
Sometimes it is. You know, sometimes it is. I love a challenge. You know, it's basically back to the Adrenaline Film Project. One of the reasons why that's such a creative and rewarding process is because it's so challenging. We're making short films in 72 hours. And what I say to those filmmakers, I say, listen, when you're in a box, sometimes the only way out is up, right? So when you're surrounded, when you're being challenged and it seems like you have nowhere to turn, sometimes you're inspired to just elevate your game and take it to a next level. And that's what happened with Truth or Dare. It wasn't even a phone call. I was in a general meeting with Jason Blum. It was one of the first times I'd ever met him. And we were just spitballing. And he said, Universal wants to make a movie, a supernatural horror movie called Truth or Dare. And I said, do you have a treatment? Do you have a script? Do you have anything? He said, no, that's it. And just right on the spot, I said, well, if I made that movie, this is how it would start. And I pitched the actual opening scene.
The petrol state.
In Truth or Dare. And I finished the scene. I just made it up on the spot. And he said, well, what happens next? And I said, I don't know. I'm just making this up. So I love a challenge. And it makes me more creative when I'm being challenged. It's why I like directing, because every day is a challenge. There's always things going wrong. And you have to find a way to be creative even in that space. And I actually get more creative in those moments. I enjoy it more than writing sometimes, because writing, you're just looking at this abyss of possibilities. Like, you can do anything. There's no constraints when you're writing most of the time. But when you're directing, all you're doing is bumping up against walls. But I actually thrive in that kind of environment. So with Imaginary, what happened was I just signed a first look deal with Blumhouse after Truth or Dare and Fantasy Island. And Jason again challenged me. By the way, I'm finding a theme here. I didn't even realize this until we had this conversation. He challenged me to make a classic Blumhouse film. You know, Truth or Dare and Fantasy Island are really not like classic Blumhouse films as far as their story points, their characters, their settings. You know, a classic Blumhouse film is in a house. It's a family. Yeah. There's a bump in the night, right? And so he said, Wadlow, I want to know what your version of that is. And I'd always wanted to make a movie about an imaginary friend because I love playing with subjectivity. I love saying to an audience, is this real? Is this not? If it's not real, does it still have real world consequences? What could those be? Right? I enjoy that back and forth with an audience as a filmmaker. And then my good friends, Greg Erb and Jason Ormlin, I invited them to Blumhouse to pitch ideas, and they pitched this notion of an evil teddy bear. And I said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take Jason's challenge. We're going to take my desire to make an imaginary friend movie, and we're going to take your idea for this evil teddy bear, and we're going to combine them. And that's where the film Imaginary came from.
So if Jason Blum, say, rings you up out the blue and says a film about, I don't know, a podcaster who can reach through a screen and yank your ears off or something like that, straight away your head's ticking, straight away that you're just assessing that.
Well, first of all, yes, straight away I would be assessing anything Jason Blum calls me about because the guy is a genius. He is a producer of historic proportions in film history. And years from now, when film students are studying film history, they're going to be talking about Jason Blum the same way we talk about David O. Selznick and Ballberg and people like that. Second of all, I would take it seriously because he would call me with a good idea. And I'm not sure that idea you just pitched is a good idea.
I'm just curious.
So if he pitched that specific idea, I'd be like, what's going on, Jason? You seem a little bit off because normally you call me up with gems, and this is not quite one of those. But yes, I would take anything that he pitched me very seriously.
But presumably there's got to be something in there that's primal for you as well. Because I again, going back to Truth or Dare, if memory serves, it was a colleague of mine you spoke to, and you talked about how that tapped into oral surgery you had as a kid, just in terms of helping determine the look of kind of the film that you were going for. And you just like reaching deep into the recesses of your brain and almost mining your own life. And imaginary, again, just feels like something. I mean, were I just taking an article of your career and just trying to assess you from a mile off, and it's just like you were having nightmares as a kid.
Yeah.
You know, it's that kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, it's a funny thing being creative and being an artist. You're sort of working on multiple levels. There's the sort of the technical level, like how can we do this? What's a cool technical thing I want to do in this moment as a filmmaker? Then there's like this like collaborative level where you're allowing all your partners to contribute. And sometimes you might not even understand their contribution, but you just know that it's making the movie better. So it's not really coming from you. It's coming from this outside source. Then there's a whole other level where you're like thinking about movies and TV shows you've seen in your career and your life that have affected you, and you're asking why they've affected you and they're influencing choices you're making. And then there's this like other level, like way deep down, that's just like your own personal experience in life. And sometimes you're aware of how it's affecting your choices, but then other times you really have no idea. Like I'd forgotten about that whole thing with Truth or Dare and the smile, and I had some jaw surgery. But obviously, like all that trauma around my mouth and my jaw at a very tender age in my early teens really affected me psychologically, and I was tapping into that with Truth or Dare. And I would say with Imaginary, to kind of bring it back to this movie, there are two things that really affected me profoundly that I think probably impacted this film and the way I told the story. The one is sort of on that kind of pop culture level, which is I saw Poltergeist when I was six and it messed me up. Like I was a normal, sweet little kid and I saw this movie. My parents took me to see this Spielberg produced movie and it was terrifying and it ruined me. I had horrible nightmares for years, night terrors, full on night terrors after seeing that
movie.
And then I would say the other thing for my own personal life is, my parents got divorced when I was, I think, 3 years old. And I was raised by two very happy, well-adjusted families. My mother remarried and my father remarried, and I love my step-parents. And so I would say I'm the product of successful blended families. And with Imaginary, I wanted to tell the story of a successful blended family.
I'm going to deliberately spoil a light on Imaginary, which makes it quite difficult to ask certain questions about it. But I found it quite interesting that you sent your male character out on the, you just put him in a car and send him off. fairly early on. I mean, he's as much as he's a familiar face to certain people, and again, I'm going very, very spoiler-like, that struck me as an interesting choice. And I mean, you've been talking quite a lot about the Truth or Dare 2 that you didn't make, and about the left field choice you'd have gone with that. It kind of strikes me in your filmmaking, you're either doing, you're not repeating yourself, you're not photocopying yourself. And I don't know, when you're writing something like that, are you looking for the left turn? Are you looking just to just knock us slightly off kilter a little bit?
Well, there's this, I can't remember where I first heard this expression. It was somewhere in film school, maybe. It was early in my development as a filmmaker. But audiences, actually, let me back up even a little bit more. I'm very interested in the audience. Like, I'm not one of these filmmakers who makes movies for myself. I actually don't believe fundamentally that that's even what we're doing. I'm not making a movie. I am making a thing that an audience can watch and then create meaning when they perceive that story through the filter of their own lives, right? So what I'm doing is I'm acknowledging that the end product is not the movie. The end product is the meaning the audience makes when they see the movie. So I know it sounds a little theoretical, but it is really fundamental to the way I approach storytelling. I'm saying to you, the audience member, you are an active participant in this process. You are not passive. Right? You're not just a consumer of the thing that I have made or that we have made. You are a part of the filmmaking team, right? So by doing that, I'm really inviting them, the audience, this idea into the process. So one of the things I always think about is, what does the audience want? The audience wants the same but different. And when I say that, I mean, if you have a movie where the bad guy, like a lot of movies, people will say, oh, the hero one, it's so predictable. Well, that movie had too much of the same, right? But say you had a movie where, like, in the final scene, the villain killed the hero, and that was the end of the movie.
Yeah.
The audience would also say, well, that movie was garbage. Well, because ultimately, that movie was too much of the different. You got to strike the balance. You want the same, but different. So I'm always trying to think in the choices that we're making, how are we giving the audience something that is satisfying because it's familiar, but it's also a surprise, right? So when it comes to sending off our male character, Max, there was lots of debates about how and when that should happen. It really came from this idea that the audience wants our heroes to rise to the occasion and figure it out on their own. That's the same. Well, the difference is they're going to have to do it in a surprising way. And it's not going to be because, you know, dad comes home and helps them.
One of the best examples of that I'd heard, of a move that could have completely unseated an audience. We had a critic over here, Barry Norman, late great Barry Norman, and he watched The Fugitive. And absolutely loved The Fugitive, but said the one thing that would make it even better is if they reverse the casting. If they swap Tommy Lee Jones and Harrison Ford and bang on the money, never forgotten that. And whenever I see someone just take a slight left turn like that, I always think of the Harrison Ford, Tommy Lee Jones inverting a little bit. You've talked Poltergeist a little bit there. As I understand it, this film, Imaginary, I watched it the other night. I think it's got a 15 certificate in the UK, but you're not going heavy on it. Yeah, I mean, a lot of this, I mean, the title, obviously, but a lot of this you're leaving for us to decide for ourselves. I thought it's quite a harsh 15, actually. I think it was the drug use that got you over the line over here.
And by the way, we even have a joke in this script. This is not a huge spoiler, but the drug use, we have a character say that it was allergy medicine. It wasn't actually a drug. And that's why we got a PG-13 in the States, because we explicitly say it's not a drug.
It doesn't work in Britain.
No.
we're tired. But were you aiming slightly younger? Younger audience is probably the wrong way of putting it. But a broader audience, was that the kind of, because Poltergeist was PG, wasn't it, when it originally came out?
Yeah, and it sparked a debate in the US about the rating system.
It was that Temple of Doom, wasn't it? Yeah,
and PG-13 kind of came out of that conversation with Temple of Doom, and I think maybe Gremlins too is a part of that conversation. Yeah. I can't remember, but PG-13 came out of that time period here. Definitely not younger. I would say certainly broader. Like, I like making movies for a broad audience. Again, back to the longer speech I gave about like the audience's role in my process, I want as many people as possible to see my movies. So I do think about that, but I don't really think about the rating. You know, the story drives the rating. If, you know, when you're making a movie about a slasher, it's going to be more violent and you're going to get a more intense rating. This is ultimately a movie about a child's imagination. And yes, it's very scary. It's not a movie for children, but it is a movie for a broad audience. And it is a horror movie about the power of creativity. So that alone kind of sets you up to keep a lot of the terror off camera and implied.
Yes, which I'll put in the notes of this about what you did with the trailer for that. I'm sure you've been asked about it an awful lot already. So I'm just coming to the end of this conversation, though. And I do just wonder if I could just get you to reflect a little bit, because reading into your story, I mean, you touched on Cry Wolf right at the start, this $1 million film that, did you get John Bon Jovi in it or something like that?
Yes.
And which for a first film. And then three years later, you're making a $20 million action film with four cameras, and we're sat here with I think it's the eighth film you've directed, I've counted, and quite a few near drive-bys of films you've nearly directed as well. Can I take you back then to the person who just finished Cry Wolf, and just the human being response to what that person would have thought of what you've done since, and the fact that you're sitting here eight movies on with presumably plenty more percolating in your head?
I got a bunch of things I want to say in response to that. First, thank you for that question. That was really thoughtful, and it means a lot to me. It really means a lot to me. I don't want to understate how touched I am by the thought that went behind that question. Second, I actually do this thing in my life. I call it the Got Milk trick. So in the States, we had this campaign called Got Milk, right? It was an ad campaign for milk consumption. By the way, I bet you didn't think I would be answering this question this way. So,
that's exactly what I had written down here.
So, one of the very first ads they did that I remember vividly when I was a kid, there was this like skinny, like 13-year-old in like a blue tank top that was oversized, and he was on a set. And there's like a freestanding mirror, I think a Chevalier mirror. And in the mirror, they had comped this really ripped guy in a blue tank top who was in his like, you know, late 20s or early 30s. And the kid's holding a glass of milk. And he says, "Who are you?" to the guy in the mirror. And the guy in the mirror says, "I'm you if you keep drinking milk." And then this like spectacular 90s girl in like a high kind of waisted leotard with her hair in a scrunchie all feathered up, like comes into the mirror and puts her arms around the ripped guy. And the kid goes, "Who's that?" And the guy in the mirror goes, "That's your girlfriend." And then the kid shotguns the glass of milk. And it made such an impression on me because I still to this day do this thing I call the Got Milk trick, which is whenever I get some bad news, when one of my drive-by opportunities to make a movie falls through or something doesn't open or is received the way I'd hoped, what I do is I kind of push myself back in time and I pretend I'm the guy in the mirror talking to 13-year-old me collecting comic books and action figures and being a film nerd. And I say, "This is your life now. This is what you're doing. These are the movies you're making. These are the kind of stories you're telling." And 13-year-old me is ecstatic, is beside himself. Yeah. He's so happy. So, you know, to answer your question, I think the filmmaker who had just finished Cry Wolf, if he could see the movies I'd made and the career I'd had in the last almost 20 years, he would be so happy. He would be equally ecstatic. He would think, you know, how cool it is that you've had an opportunity to tell all these stories and work with so many incredible actors and work in different genres, and that you've been able to just build a life as an artist. That's no small feat in today's economy, and certainly in Hollywood. And then he would also say to me, "Why haven't you done more?" Like, why haven't you done
perfect,
bigger, more perfect, exciting things? Like, get back to it, buddy. Thank you again for that question. It's fun to think about, and it's nice to look back, but also it's exciting to look forward.
Jeff Wadlow, we're out of time, sadly. I want to say a huge congratulations on the Adrenaline Film Project in particular. I think that's such an important thing to do. And congratulations on banging the drum on that. And congratulations on film number 8 as well. I look forward to chatting to you for film number 9.
I can't wait.
Thank the very so best much. To you.
Take care.
Thank you.
And that brings to an end my conversation with Jeff Wadlow. Just to reiterate, Imaginary is playing in UK cinemas now. It's in cinemas around the world as well, I think, but this podcast is made in the UK, so I can say with some authority it's in UK cinemas now. That's it, though, for this episode of Film Stories, where you've got to get off to the cinema to go and watch Imaginary. If I've not bored you completely, you can find more from me on Blue Sky and Twitter at Simon Brew. Film Stories is Film Stories on Blue Sky and Twitter as well. We're at filmstories.co.uk. Oh, God, what are we on? We're at facebook.com/filmstoriesonline. Filmstories.co.uk is our website. It's updated every weekday with movie news, features, reviews, games, TV stuff as well, all in the mix there. We are also at, well, we have a shop where we sell magazines. I'm doing this really well this time, I'm sure you'll agree. We have a shop where we sell things, store.filmstories.co.uk, print magazines, print film magazines that we make ourselves and sell around the world. Thank you to everyone who supports us there. If you go to YouTube, youtube.com/filmstories, if you can subscribe there, we're launching a few more videos there just over the next week or two as well. So any support is much, much appreciated. But before I forget everything else that I'm supposed to say, I'm going to go for a lie down and a coffee, because I've comfortably smashed this final outro part of the podcast. All it remains for me to say is you all take care, you look after yourselves. I'll be back soon with your regular episode of Film Stories. Thanks for listening. Bye bye.